There's a very fascinating Gemara Maseches Kiddushin where the Gemara talks about Kohanim. When Kohanim are wearing Big Day Kuhuna in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, so we know, are they allowed to wear the Big Day Kuhuna even when they're not doing the Avodah? Says the Gemara, no, for a number of reasons. Number one, because Big Day Kuhuna actually contain Shatnez. Now you ask yourself, you're not allowed to have Kilayim, you're not allowed to have Shatnez, but for Big Day Kuhuna, the Torah says you're allowed to. So that's reason number one. Reason number two is probably because it belongs to the property of Hekdesh, and therefore I cannot just use it for my own purposes. If I'm going somewhere else or I need to do something else, what right would I have to use the property of Hekdesh to go and wear these clothing for any non-Avoda-related matter? And therefore the Gemara says that Kohanim are supposed to take off the clothing after they complete their Avoda, and they're supposed to then put on some kind of civilian clothing. However, says the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin, does that mean that the moment that a Kohen steps out of the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash, he has to immediately take all his clothing off? That would seem very unreasonable as well. But he's not doing Avodah from the time he finishes his job in the Beis HaMikdash till he walks to the locker room, wherever it is, downstairs, upstairs, wherever they had it. So there's a couple of minutes in between. Says the Gemara, that would be a very unreasonable expectation. And the Gemara introduces us to a concept of Lo nitna Torah la malachei hasheres. The Torah was given to human beings. The Torah was not given to malachei hasheres. And therefore, the assumption is that we have a right to act in a reasonable manner, and we don't have to expect ourselves, the moment that we are finished with the avoda, we don't have to expect ourselves to do something that most regular human beings would not do in that circumstance. I was reminded when I read that Gemara of a comment of, I think, the Kutzker. The Kutzker pointed out that right after Kabbalah HaTorah, the Torah basically sums up the expectations, and the Torah says, "Va'anshe kodesh tiyun li." What is the bottom line of all of the entirety of Torah? So he says, it's that you should be kedoshim, you should be kedoshim tiyu, you should be a holy people, and therefore the Torah is made to elevate us, and to make us think differently, to make us react differently, to make us behave differently, and therefore, he says, that is why the Torah uses this choice phrase, "Va'anshe kodesh tiyun li," instead of "Umalache kodesh tiyun li." The Torah does not say, I gave you these rules and therefore I expect you to be living lives of angels. No. I know that you're all human beings and I know that you have all kinds of challenges and I know that sometimes human beings have different kinds of emotions or different kinds of things that pull them in different directions. And as a result of that, the Torah says, use all the rules of the Torah and act like human beings. Va'anshei kodesh tiyun li. Try to elevate your life in a way of kedusha. Try to live in a way that is commensurate with the laws of the Torah, but you're not expected to be angels, and that's what the Gemara says here. We have another Gemara, Maseches Pesachim, where the Gemara introduces us, not the Gemara, the Rishonim, explain the Gemara based on the same concept. So the Gemara there is talking about how far does a person need to go to ensure that there is no chametz in their house before Pesach. So we know there's an Isser of Bal Yira u'Bal Yimatzeh, there's an Isser for a person to have chametz in their home on Pesach. And because of that, the Chachamim made a chi of Bedika, Chazal said that you have to do Bedikas chametz beforehand, which is interesting. We don't say by every other Isser in the Torah that I have to check my house to make sure that there is no non-kosher food in the refrigerator. I don't assume that there's any non-kosher food, so why do I have a mitzvah bedika here? Okay, a whole story for Pesach time, we'll get back to it, but we have a mitzvah before Pesach of bedikas chametz. So says the Gemara, how far do I have to be bodik chametz? So the Gemara says, the basic rule is, kol makom shemachnisim chametz, any place where it's reasonable to assume that chametz was brought into, so that's the place where I have to check. But let's say I have a laundry room, and a person doesn't normally go into the laundry room unless you have little kids who are running around with chametz all over the place, but normally if you have adults, they're not going to go into a laundry room with chametz, so that's not chayiv and bedika, because it's not reasonable that a person would have brought chametz there. So then the Gemara tells us, what about a place, like, why don't we have to be concerned, shema giraso chulda, maybe we have to be concerned that some kind of rodent took a little bit of chametz from one room and brought it into another, or took it from my house and brought it to your house, or took it from one location to another. Or maybe I should even say I should have to continuously do a bedika the entire Pesach, because maybe there's a rodent that took a piece of bread from the supermarket and ran over to my house. So the Gemara says you don't have to worry about such a thing. But the Gemara doesn't explain why. And the Rishonim say the reason why is because ein ladavar sof. And the way the Rishonim there explain it is, lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasheres. The Torah doesn't expect me to be living an unreasonable life. How am I going to do this? Every moment of Pesach, I'm going to be standing there with a flashlight, looking underneath everything, everywhere, to make sure that there was nothing there. I did a reasonable bedika. I did whatever I could. And that's it. Anything beyond that, we assume, lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasheres. So here comes a very interesting application of that. There's a sefer called Shailos HaTshuvos Ginos V'Radim, which was written in the late 1600s, early 1700s. The Ginos V'Radim writes, there's two different Ginos V'Radim. The Prima Gadim wrote a sefer called Ginos V'Radim. It's a separate one. And this is a sefer called Shailos HaTshuvos Ginos V'Radim. And he says, why is it that we find that there is a discrepancy between Tefillin and Mezuzah on the one hand and Sefer Torah on the other hand? I would assume they're all written on parchment and they all have Hebrew letters on it and they all have to be written in a very specific fashion. So I would assume that the rules that govern the writing of a Sefer Torah and a Mezuzah and a Tefillin should all be the same. So why do we have that Sefer Torah is on its own and Tefillin and Mezuzah is the other way? Now, you may think it's the other way in the wrong direction. If I would say one group is more chamer than the other, which one would you say it is? Sefer Torah, because Sefer Torah is Sefer Torah. After all, the Sefer Torah is the entirety of Torah. Tefillin is just a few sections, and mezuzah is even smaller than the tefillin. So I would have said mezuzah and tefillin is probably less chamer. Sefer Torah is a Sefer Torah. And yet, it's counterintuitive, but the halacha is that we have many kulas by Sefer Torah that we don't find by tefillin and mezuzah. One of them, for example, is a tefillin and mezuzah has to be written kisidran, has to be written in the order in which it is listed in the Torah. So you have to write it, everything in order. When it comes to a Sefer Torah, if let's say a sofer writes, you know, a certain segment of the Sefer Torah first, and then you write a segment of the Sefer Torah later, then you tie everything together, you sew it together, it would be fine. So why is it that by one aspect, by Sefer Torah, we find that it could be even Shalok Kisidron? And when you find by a tefillin or mezuzah, that it has to be written Kisidron. That and a few other examples that the Achronim are wondering, why do we find that discrepancy? And they answer, because tefillin and mezuzah, because they are so limited, because they only expect the sofer to write a little section of the Torah, therefore it's easy for a sofer to follow the rules and do everything exactly like this. But a Sefer Torah, we know, with the best sofer in the world, it still takes a long time to write a Sefer Torah. And because of that, we have to be mindful of the fact, lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasheris. And therefore, says the Ginos V'Radim, what do you expect? A sofer is going to sit there and be able to concentrate for who knows how long, forever and ever, and do everything exactly, consider on everything exactly the way it's supposed to be? It sounds very unreasonable. And therefore, the assumption of the Ginos V'Radim is, that is why the halacha would differentiate between the writing of a Sefer Torah, where on the other hand, we have the writing of Tefillin and Mezuzah, which would be a lot more chamer than the writing of a Sefer Torah itself. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman has an interesting tshuva in the Mincha Shlomo, where he discusses being mafrish meiser on egozim. Egozim are walnuts, right? So you have to be mafrish tumas and meiser on fruits and vegetables in Eretz Yisrael, and walnuts have to have meiser taken off of them as well. So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Arbach writes, what do you do about the following problem? Again, if I buy walnuts in the store, I'm buying one little package of walnuts. I'm not going to buy 10,000 baskets of it. But if I am a producer of walnuts, so I don't know how much they produce at one time, but they probably have tens of thousands of, I don't know what the measurements are, but what do you call it? Something. A lot of something, right? So whenever the halacha is, whenever I'm mafish chumas or maisers, I have to make sure that I'm taking off a certain shear, a certain size, which, okay, it's not so hard. Any manufacturer knows exactly how much they're manufacturing. So to err on the side of caution, I'll take off a little bit more. But there's another halacha that I have to take off something that is reasonable for the Kohen to be able to use. If I'm going to take off all the rotten apples, I'm going to take off all the rotten fruits and vegetables and say, oh, this is the truma and this is the meiser. What do you mean that? You can't do that. If you want to have trumas and meisers taken off, it has to be from the best, from the good part of it, from the reasonable part that you would imagine the Kohen would actually eat. So here, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, when I'm being mafrish chumas and maizes on egozim, which are so small, it's not like apples where I can see when I separate a bunch, I can see if a bunch of them are rotten. The nuts, you can't tell. Maybe some of them have nothing to show. Maybe they're rotten, maybe they're not edible, maybe they're dried out, maybe whatever it is. And therefore he says, how can I be mafrish meiser on egozim if, after all, I may be giving the Kohen a portion of this production that is not edible at all? Says Rav Shlomo Zalman, lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasheris. What do you think? The Torah expects you to go and look at every single one? The Torah is saying as a general rule, when I give shumas and meisers, I have to try to give from the best that I have or from the edible parts that I have. If it so turns out that you weren't able to make sure that every single last one is perfect, so be it. Lo nitna Torah l'malachei hasheris, and that is reasonable, that is okay. There is a similar discussion, which I'm going to reframe it just a little bit, where the Gemara talks about Ashashis. Ashashis means if I have a glass. So we call it today a window. So if I have a window, so ask the Gemara the following question in Maseches Brachos. It sounds like a strange question. We know that we're not allowed to say Kriya Shema in front of an erva. What does it mean? You have somebody who's not properly dressed. You're not allowed to say Kriya Shema or Tefillah in front of that person. You have to walk away. You have to move to the side, or they have to move to the side. Something. So says the Gemara, of course, if let's say I am davening in here, and there happens to be a restroom right next door, so am I allowed to daven here? Well, I'm in front of somebody who's not dressed. The answer is, what do you mean? There's a wall in between. What's the problem? I can't see anything. They can't see me. I can't see them. It's no problem. Says the Gemara, what if the walls are made of glass? What if the walls are made of glass? Now, that would be a strange way to configure a restroom, but what if you have a wall that is made of glass? I remember I once went to a hotel in Yerushalayim where they had glass bathrooms. Very strange. So somebody told me that this, it's the Mamila Hotel, somebody told me that there is an option to press a button where you can fog up the windows or something like that, or you can frost the windows. But it was right when it opened. I think most of the guests had no idea. I remember I was there right in the beginning, the first year, and it was Sukkot's time, and I think I must have had a friend who came from America. I went to visit them. I said, can I use the bathroom? They said, sure. I went in. I'm like, this is so strange. I had no idea. But anyway, so the Gemara wants to know, erva ba'ashashis, what is the halacha when you have an erva that's standing behind the glass? Can I daven in front of such a person or not? What do you think? No. You would say no. Why not? The bottom line is, I don't care that there's a mechitza there, but you can see straight through it, and therefore it doesn't make a difference. When we talk about a mechitza for davening, you have to ask yourself, what's the reason why we need a mechitza by davening? Rav Moshe writes two different reasons. He says, really, it's just to separate men and women, mishum tznias, not that I shouldn't ever be able to look at another person. Others say that you shouldn't be able to look at each other, but some say the reason why is because we need to have a separation. Men and women should daven separately. So as long as I have a mechitza, is good enough. Again, that's a big shaila, a big question in the poskim, but here it's clear. What's the reason why I'm not allowed to say Kriya Shema in front of an erva? Because you're not supposed to look at an erva while you're saying Kriya Shema. So what does it matter if it's behind the glass, it's in front of the glass? Doesn't make a difference. So the Rashba Maseches Brachos writes, okay, so now let's get a little more practical. That doesn't happen that often, but says the Rashba, what happens in the following case? What happens if somebody wants to make Havdalah on Matzai Shabbos, and we know you have to make Havdalah, and part of it is Bori Ma'ori Ha'esh. You're supposed to see the fire. So what if I have a glass in front of that fire? Now you say, why do you have a glass in front of the fire? So why can't you just go? Why are you standing outside the window? Why don't you just go in front of the window and look? The answer is, what's the obvious case? Mirror is not a good example. What's the obvious case? Oh, that would be a good one. Correct. They have a tube with a light inside. Or another example would be a light bulb, right? A light bulb is considered Aish. If you're stuck and you don't have an opportunity to make Havdalah on a candle, you can make it on a light bulb as long as you see the filament, which is very rare. We don't really have those kind of bulbs. First of all, because most of our bulbs today are LED. And second of all, because even at the time when they were not LED, most of them are frosted. So you can't see filament anyway. But ask the Rashba, would I be able to say Bori Ma'ori Ha'esh when I have a glass that is going to be separating between myself and the fire? And he gets into a whole discussion, the Bir Halacha discusses it. Hanogele in Yonena, what's more important for us is, what about all of us who wear glasses? Right? So would that be the same? Would you tell me that every time I need to do a mitzvah that requires me to see something, I have to actually take off my glasses? So the Shavus Yaakov has a fascinating tshuva. He says, chalitza is a very rare mitzvah. Chalitza is a mitzvah which is very unfortunate when you have a couple where the husband passes away. Husband and wife are married. The husband passes away and they left no children behind. No biological children behind. We actually just had this case where there was a couple that was married, never had children, but adopted children. And they were considered their children for many, many, many years. And when they went to the Rabbanut, this woman's husband passed away. And then when she went to get remarried, so they had looked back at the file and they asked, did you ever have any children? She said, yeah, of course I have children. Here they are. She didn't think that it was relevant to say that they were adopted. And it turns out they never really had children. And now she went and got remarried. And now it turns out she's married to someone she's not allowed to be married to because she didn't have chalitza. Very sad story, but it wasn't her fault. At the time, she wasn't really understanding what the question was. They should have been more clear. They should have asked her, do you have any biological children? And the children that you have, are they adopted or are they your own natural children? Anyway, very sad story. So That was the recent story. So the Shvus Yaakov writes, when you have chalitza, the Torah says very specific instructions of exactly how you're supposed to perform a chalitza. And the Gemara says, as part of it is, the woman has to spit in front of the bezdin, which is very uncomfortable, very strange. I've been to a chalitza a few times before. It's a very, very uncomfortable situation. But it says, v'yarka le'enei hazakenim. It says, the dayanim have to actually see that she spits, right? Most of us, if we had saliva in our mouth and we had to get it out, you don't want to do that in front of other people. But here it says specifically, v'yarka le'enei hazakenim. It says, she has to spit and the zakenim have to see. So the Shvus Yaakov wonders, what happens? If I have a blind eye, and the Gemara says, of course, that's not going to work. Why? Because he can't see. Torah says he has to see. What if I have a dayan who needs glasses? So he can't really see, but he could see once he puts his glasses on. So is he considered a kosher dayan for a chalitza? Or perhaps not. And the Bir Halacha or the Ber Hetev, one of them writes, what do we do by Kiddush Levana? Let's say it's freezing outside. Can I say Kiddush Levana behind the window? Or do you say that I actually have to go outside and see the Levana myself? So all of this leads me to the next point, which is, what about when we go in the opposite direction? Instead of somebody who needs glasses, what about when you have something that is not visible to the naked eye? Not because I have a poor eyesight, but because it is so microscopic, it is so small, and the naked eye is unable to see it. What does the halacha say about that? So this is actually a very interesting shaila that comes up originally in the Sefer Binas Adam. Binas Adam is not such a famous Sefer, but it's written by a very famous author. The author is Rabbi Avram Danzig, who lived in the late 1700s, passed away in the 1820s. Do we know who Rabbi Avram Danzig is? The author of? No, close. Before the Aruch HaShulchan, author of? Chayadam. Rabbi Avram Danzig is the author of the Chayadam, and he also wrote a Sefer called Binas Adam, just as important as the Chayadam. But it's not an Aruch Chaim. So the Chayei Adam is very famous because it basically goes through all of our lives. So that's much easier. But the Binas Adam is a little bit less well known. But the Binas Adam is a very important sefer on Isser V'Heter. And there, the Binas Adam, the Chayei Adam, discusses the following case. Has anybody in the room ever used vinegar in a recipe before? Yeah, it's part of Sharon, yes, thank you. So you've used vinegar in a recipe. So here's the question that the Binas Adam asks. Anybody who knows the ABCs of science understands, how does vinegar become vinegar? So it starts off as wine, and then the wine ferments, and then what happens? How does it ferment? It turns into vinegar. So how does that happen? Basically, we have microscopic bacteria that combines with the oxygen that is inside of the alcohol, which then continues to turn it, to make it rot more and more until it turns into vinegar. Now, vinegar is not something that we don't want. Sometimes we want vinegar. If our good wines would turn into vinegar, we would be very unhappy. But there are times when we do want vinegar. So how am I ever allowed to have vinegar when I know that the whole process actually happened from transitioning to wine to vinegar? It only happened because there were bugs involved. And that means the bugs didn't go anywhere. The bugs are still there. So how am I ever allowed to consume vinegar when I know that this is how it came about? That is the question that is raised.
What? Bacteria,
yeah. Okay, but it's okay, 1 second. So he says, Mashakasav Lesser Chometz. So he says, somebody wrote me a letter and he says, maybe we should have a new chumra. Maybe we're no longer allowed to consume vinegar. Now, you're no longer allowed to consume vinegar, says the Binas Adam, Hevelu. Not just I don't accept your chumra, but he says it's nonsense. Why? Sha'arei HaTorah Amra Binazir Chometz Yain. He says, the Torah says that a Nazir is not allowed to drink vinegar. What does that mean? What's the implication of that? Only a Nazir is not allowed to drink vinegar, but everybody else is allowed to drink vinegar. So how could it be? What do you mean? Everybody else is vinegar. How did it become vinegar? The same way the Nazir's yain became vinegar. What?
The same way it became wine.
Of course. Everything happens the same way. And therefore, he says, it can't be. Michlal til achrin ishar, v'chein kasa barus, v'tavata, whatever. Do you think the Torah would only would expect us to know this on our own without telling us? It can't be. Everybody knows that vinegar has existed for the longest time. And therefore, it must be, from the fact that the Torah didn't mention it, it must be that there is nothing wrong with vinegar. Now, why is there nothing wrong with vinegar? He first lays down the rule, and he says, vinegar is fine. But why? So he answers, because lo asra Torah masha b'koach ela masha yata lepoel. So he doesn't really get to the bottom of it. He says, this is only potential embryonic stages of some microscopic something. It's not a bug right now, the way it is, like you correctly said. And therefore he says, this is not really something we have to be concerned about. The Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chil Epstein, who lived around 100 years later, fleshes it out a little bit more. And he says, Yesh mi shekasa b'shem chachme ha-teva. There are some scientists who tell me, Da'amistakel b'zchuchis ha-megadeles. If you take, what's that? A microscope. Yira b'chometz malei toloim. If you put vinegar under a microscope, I assume nobody here is going to ever want to have vinegar again. But if you look at vinegar under a microscope, you will see that it is malei toloim. You will see that it is swarming with bugs. What? Oh. So he says, Amnam shamati shebechol mine mayim uviyichud megishamim malei beruim. He says, I was told that if you look at water under a microscope, you'll see the same thing. So what are you going to say? You're not allowed to have water anymore? Maybe the answer is yes, you're not allowed to have water. But the Aruch HaShulchan says that cannot be. And he says, Bialdusi shamati. When I was a young child, I heard me piachat shai b'mer chakim. I heard from, it's amazing how he describes this. Now, we have the ability, you want to see something under a microscope, so go check it out. He says, I once heard when I was a child that somebody went somewhere and he was able to get his hands on a microscope and he saw in a museum somewhere that there were many, many different kinds of organisms living inside of all of these liquids under the water, under the thing. He says the Torah did not asser bacteria. After all, you can't see it. If I can't see it, then it's as if it's not here. The Torah expects me to be a human being. The Torah doesn't expect me to live with a microscope. And therefore, if the Torah did not say that vinegar is asser, it must be the reason why is because even though the origins of vinegar may come from bacteria or may come from some microscopic bugs that is inside of the wine that turns it into where it is, and even if the water has some kind of microscopic bugs inside of it as well, we don't have to be concerned because lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharis. After all, says the Aruch HaShulchan, how can you breathe? All of us breathe, and we all know that there is bacteria in the air. So you're telling me every time you open your mouth, you're consuming bacteria. So you have to tell a person to walk around with a triple mask all day long and make sure that no bacteria with filters, it doesn't make sense. Says the Aruch HaShulchan, it can't be. So what's the heter? The heter is that it's lo nira le'inayim. The heter is that you can't see it. And the Torah lays down the principle that lo nitna Torah le'malachei hasharis. There's a very interesting case that is brought up in the Teferis Yisrael. What about it? No, so there, fruits and vegetables is a different story. There, you could see it with the naked eye, it's just hard to find it. Right? So there, you're just not looking properly. Right? But if you, let's say, cut open a strawberry, you'll see it. So it's not that your naked eye can't see it. It's there, and you can see it, you just don't know how to look for it. That's the problem. That's why fruits and vegetables are a little different. Again, within reason. Yeah?
So what was the whole controversy with the water?
So the controversy with the water was the copepods were a little bit different, because the whole discussion with the water was, maybe we should assume that the water is worse because you can actually see them without a microscope. I remember when that whole controversy was going on, so they came to the Beis Medrash. I think it was Talmidim of Reb David Feinstein, if I'm not mistaken, were the ones, I don't remember. I think they were the ones who were very involved in this whole story. I don't remember exactly who they were. But I remember they came to the Beis Medrash with a big tank full of water, and we were all just sitting there watching for like 5 minutes, and you could see, if you look very carefully, you could see that things are swimming around. You could see it. So that's why it was a bigger Shiloh there with the water. And that was the question. But the Teferis Yisrael in his commentary on Mishnayis has a very interesting Shiloh. He says, we know that in order for a fish to be kosher, it has to have fins and scales. So he says, there was once a situation. Hine Abu Senu Sipulanu. He said, our forefathers told us a story. He said, I didn't see this myself, but somebody once told me, Shazeh Kenun Osamach Shana. Every 50 or 60 years, that there is a fish that surfaces on the top of the ocean and the fishermen catch it, and it's a kosher fish even though you can't see it. What do you mean you can't see? He says, because the scales are microscopic. If you put it under a microscope, you will see the scales. But if you leave it the way it is and you just look at it with your own naked eye, you won't be able to see the scales. And a big machlokas broke out whether or not we would be able to assume that such a fish is considered to be kosher or perhaps not. The Pischei Tshuva actually quotes a case from the Maharsham, not the Pischei Tshuva on the bottom of the Shulchan Aruch. There's a separate sefer called Pischei Tshuva, a small sefer recently, in the last 100 years. So he writes in the name of the Maharsham, who was a big posek in Europe. He says that there was some printing press that was able to put out a sefer that had such tiny letters you couldn't read it. It was considered to be, you've seen these things. You see, like, people say it's a skula to walk around with this tehillim or with this whatever it is, right? So somebody wanted to know, they got one of these svarim, and you absolutely cannot read it. It's in tiny, tiny print, and you know you can't read unless you have a magnifying glass. So do I have an obligation to make sure that this is considered treated like Kisvei HaKodesh, or would you say, come on, that's not a sefer. If you can't read it, it's not a sefer at all. And therefore, maybe I should say, you're allowed to bring it into places where you otherwise wouldn't bring Sifrei Kodesh. You're allowed to, you know, treat it however you want because it's not a sefer. After all, if I can't read it, it's not considered to be a sefer. That was the big discussion that he had. Now, someone took this 1,000 steps further to a shaila that is nogea to very, very many cases. All the cases that we spoke about are Isser V'Heter. Now, I'm not trying to downplay Isser V'Heter and say, if I eat something that may not be kosher, it's not so bad. It is bad. It's Timtum Alev, it's a problem, you violate Isurim, but it doesn't come close to the threshold of Pikuach Nefesh. If you get involved in a Pikuach Nefesh Shaila, you have to understand the gravity of the Shaila that you're dealing with. So Rav Moshe writes in a Tshuva Nigris Moshe Yerodei Chelik Beis the following interesting story. There's a major discussion that has been talked about ad nauseum. What is considered the definition of death, right? And nobody has really been able to clearly define how we consider someone to be dead or not. And the reason why this is a very, very complicated question today and not in the times of the Gemara is because in the times of the Gemara, they had no machines. So if somebody was dead, they were dead. We could see. Now, when you have so many other machines that are keeping a person alive, the question is, how do we determine when a person is dead? And we can monitor brain activity and we can see what's going on. And with a certain intervention, you can bypass the heart and the lungs, right? We have that today. What's it called? A what? No, what's that called? ECMO, yes, an ECMO can bypass the heart and the lungs. So, like, this is a phenomenon that was never imagined in previous generations, and it's miraculous even today. Hospitals do not have a lot of these machines because they're very expensive, and it's very unusual that we'll use them. So, how to define death is something that is very, very complicated, but understand that defining death is something that requires tremendous shoulders because that is really defining pikuach nefesh. Am I murdering someone when I determine that they are dead? Or do I assume they're actually dead and I'm not doing anything? I'm just doing the right thing by allowing them to be brought to kvura. These are very, very weighty questions. So, of course, Rav Moshe Feinstein weighs in on the issue because this was a raging issue in his day, 50 years ago. Of course, this was a big issue, continues to be. So he said somebody came to him with the following suggestion. Somebody came and said the following. Maybe we should say, "Be'im harofim roim teguvos be'electric radiogram." If you are following on the screen and the doctors can see some kind of rhythm, lomar she'eno klum v'nechsham meis imach hivsik linshom. He says, maybe we should assume that if somebody stops breathing, they are considered to be dead. Ah, you look on the screen and you see that there's activity going on in the body. So what do you mean they're dead? It can't be dead. If he's dead, then that wouldn't be happening. So he says, no, but the halacha is that we only recognize something that is nirelei naim. And the same reason you're allowed to drink vinegar, and the same reason you're allowed to make sure that you can breathe because there are bacteria flying around in the air and you allow them into your mouth, and the same reason why we say all these other cases that lo nitna tar lemalachei hashareis, maybe in determining death we should say the same thing. Lo nitna tar lemalachei hashareis, the Torah wants us to use our own sense of reality. What do you see? Do you see the person is alive or not? Don't look at the screen. Forget what the screen sees. The screen is seeing something beneath the surface. So the same way you're not mechuyev to go with a microscope and see something and that will determine whether or not it's kosher, so too maybe you don't have to go with a machine beneath the surface of somebody's body and be able to monitor what's going on inside, what you can't see. So the moment that I see that somebody stops breathing, says Rav Moshe, maybe that should be the determining factor to whether or not they are alive. If they stop breathing, then every doctor will tell you, look at the patient. You don't see anything. There's a machine that's telling me otherwise. I don't care about the machine. That's not relevant. The same way we don't worry about machines in other areas of halacha and microscopes don't really count. So too over here, I shouldn't worry about this either. Says Rav Moshe, somebody wanted to suggest that this is the way it should work. And Rav Moshe writes that there was a big discussion. My father actually told me he once had the shaila. Gemara tells us, the Gemara says it's a halacha l'moshe misinai. It's in Maseches Shabbos, it's in Maseches Megillah, it's also Maseches Menachos. Three times the Gemara has the same halacha, that you need tefillin to be a perfect ribua. They need to be a perfect square. Now, Shulchan Aruch says if your tefillin are not a square, it's ma'akeh b'dievet. Your tefillin are not kosher. Now, what does that mean? Now, that means if it's a circle, it's not kosher. Or if one of the corners got chipped off, that's not kosher. But my father said there was somebody who used to come to his shir, who is a dentist or an orthodontist, something. He dealt with teeth all day long. And he said that he has trained his eyes to see things with precision, because I guess when he does the fillings or whatever it is, it has to be just perfect. So he said, whenever he walks into shul, it bothers him that nobody's tefillin is a perfect square. Now, to most regular people who don't have such precise eyesight, it looks like a square to us. But to him, he has eyes that measure things and know exactly what is a square and what's not. So he said it really bothers him. He walks into shul and he sees this person's tefillin is puzzle, and that person's tefillin is not a square, and the other person. So it's not that it's a circle, but to his very perfected eyesight, maybe we should say that he's the one who's going to determine. Or do you say, no, we determine based on regular people, based on the hamunam. What do most regular people see when they look at this tefillin? So Ramos has a tshuva about that, and he says, even though it's true that tefillin have to be square, who is going to determine whether or not the tefillin are square? The determining factor is, do most regular people think this is square? And even if you have some kind of precise eyesight, that's like having a microscope, and that doesn't count. So Sotra Moshe says, maybe we should say over here as well, that as long as a person doesn't see the individual breathing, the patient breathing anymore, maybe we should say they are no longer considered alive. In the end, Ramosha writes, Nirala Nias Daiti She'en Okein. He goes into a whole discussion, and he says to explain why it is that he feels this is an inappropriate application of this halacha. Yes, it's true. We don't have an obligation to look at our esrog with a magnifying glass. And we don't have an obligation to take our tefillin under a microscope and see whether or not there is going to be something that makes it not perfectly square. If it looks square, it's square. If my esrog looks good, it's good. Again, you have to look. It doesn't mean you can just say, oh, I assume it's good. You have to look at it. But you don't have to go with a magnifying glass. You have no chiv to do that. So too over here, Rav Moshe says, I should have said that maybe if I don't see the patient breathing, that should be enough to determine death. Rav Moshe gets into a lengthy tshuva there in Yeredei Chelek Beis where he says that's a little bit too much of a stretch to say that. Not necessarily are the rules all going to be the same. Just because that is the way we determine other areas of halacha doesn't necessarily mean that is how we're going to determine a shailam pikuach nefesh about whether or not somebody is a rotzeach for killing a patient or whether you're doing the mitzvah of kura for letting them be buried. That's not the determining factor. There are other sources in halacha that are going to determine when a person is considered to be no longer alive. But I thought that that was a very interesting application with regard to that, where Moshe says that I should have said that, but he argues that this would not be a good application where we would apply this halacha, because he feels it's going a little bit too far when it comes to inyanim that are nogea to pikuach nefesh. Okay, we're going to stop for Maariv.